Well, hello everybody, and thanks very much, Padmavajra, for that very full and generous introduction. Thank you. So I want to talk about the attainment of enlightenment, or for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. And the first point I want to make is that this third acceptance verse takes place within the context of the other three verses. So it takes place within loyalty to our teachers, in harmony with friends and brethren, and for the benefit of all beings. And the third verse takes place within human relationships and human connections. So the third verse is, for the sake of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. And I think it's worth asking ourselves, since we've all asked for ordination, why do I practice the Dharma? Is it just to make life happier, to live a good, healthy human life, which is okay as far as it goes? Or is it for the sake of enlightenment? Is it to gain enlightenment? Do we put any limits on how much we're prepared to develop, how much we're prepared to follow the path into the unknown? Or to put it another way, do we practice to get off the wheel entirely, or is it just to make samsara work better for us? So that's not an easy question to answer. Enlightenment seems impossibly far away, impossibly distant. And it's quite difficult to write about enlightenment. In actual fact, all our practices are for the sake of enlightenment. If we go deeply enough into them. All Buddhist systems of practice work, but only in relation to the degree of intensity and wholeheartedness with which we practice them. And a lovely little aphorism from Bhante, he says, there are no higher teachings, just greater or lesser intensities of the same practice. I'll say that again. There are no higher teachings, just greater or lesser intensities of the same practice. So everything we do as Buddhists has the potentiality to lead to enlightenment, but we have to practice it with sufficient intensity and sufficient wholeheartedness. So as I said, enlightenment can seem impossibly remote and far away. And we have to find a way to relate it to our own experience. And what I found helpful in this context was a passage in the seminar on the Survey of Buddhism, Chapter 1, where Bhante talks about how to describe enlightenment to a beginner. So this is what he says. He says that first of all, you have to take a few steps back and make clear the difference between the skillful and the unskillful, the reactive process and the creative process. So you have to make the distinction between the wheel and the spiral, and on the spiral, positive states lead to more and more positive states. And then you suggest that this creative process can go on and on, just becoming more and more creative, more and more positive, more and more intense. And then you say that this process can go on and on indefinitely, and nirvana, or enlightenment, just represents the furthest point that we can imagine, like a point on the horizon. And you can say that you believe this process continues after that, but that is as far as you can imagine. And then you can say that you can relate this to your own experience. You can say that as a Buddhist, you do have some experience of greater clarity, positivity, and creativity than before you took up the Buddhist path. And you do have a stream of energy going in the direction of greater freedom and creativity. And you have confidence that that process can continue indefinitely. So there is something of the goal of enlightenment present in the experience of the path that we are already treading. The goal and the path are both contained within what we call spiral conditionality. They are both contained within Pratichasamutpada, dependent arising, the Buddha's fundamental insight at the time of his enlightenment. What this is saying is that the attainment of enlightenment depends upon setting up conditions. It does not just depend upon an act of will. So spiritual life, treading the spiral path, is a cumulative process. And you build a very, very strong and broad foundation. And what's more, it's a gradual process. And the Buddha points to this in the Udana when he's comparing the Dharma to the qualities of the great ocean. And he says, just as the mighty ocean flows down, slides and tends down gradually, and there is no abrupt precipice, so also in this Dharma discipline, the training is gradual, the action is gradual, the procedure is gradual. There is no abrupt penetration of knowledge. The attainment of enlightenment involves progressively bringing every aspect of ourselves into line with enlightenment. And one way of looking at this is through the five spiritual faculties: faith, wisdom, energy, meditation, and mindfulness. And this word for faculty is indriya, and indriya also means sense, as in the six senses. So usually our experience is driven by the six senses, by impulses to do with the six senses. Everything we do, everything we feel, everything we think often comes back to sense-based impulses. But as we take up the spiritual life, we begin to depend instead more and more on these five spiritual faculties, and they gradually take over and become the steering force of our life. So I want to just go into these really briefly, and I'm just going to go to touch on each of these. So the first one is Shraddha, or faith. And Shraddha, in its fullest expression, is a response of our whole being to enlightenment. It's placing the heart upon the three jewels. And we can do this because there's something in us that resonates with enlightenment, that responds to that enlightenment actualized outside. The potential in us for enlightenment is responding to that. And in a way, that is the most important spiritual faculty. If you can keep in touch with that spiritual faculty, then you'll want to move towards it and experience that potential in relation to the ideal more and more strongly. So faith has a touch of vision. It already has a touch of the transcendental, a touch of enlightenment. Faith is when we see through the limitations of mundane life and we have a vision of something beyond. And we know that Shraddha arises in dependence upon dukkha. But not all dukkha gives rise to Shraddha. It's only the existential dukkha that gives rise to Shraddha. A realization that there's no full and lasting satisfaction to be found in conditioned existence. So you don't have to be suffering to see that. Your life might be full of joy. You might be living a very happy life. but you just realize there's something missing. There's something more. And that's the starting point of the spiritual life. And that sets us looking for something which can actually fulfill those deepest human potential, deepest human longing. Bhante tells a story. He talked about a man coming to see him. And this man's wife had, this man's girlfriend had died in tragic circumstances. And he was absolutely distraught. He came to see Bhante. Bhante hadn't met him before. And he said he just wanted to commit himself to the spiritual life. He just wanted to commit himself to the Dharma. And he wanted to become a monk. And he seemed very sincere. And Bhante said to him, well, come back and see me. Tell me how you get on. And he went away. And he never came back. And he heard from friends of this man who went to see him that he got over his loss. And he never became a monk. He just went back to living an ordinary life and just got on with his life in an ordinary way. So on the basis of that, I think Bhante talks about the distinction between disillusionment and disgruntlement. And disgruntlement is when conditioned existence is not working for you. Maybe your life, your normal samsaric life, is not going very well. You're not really getting what you want from life. And maybe you come along to a Buddhist center, maybe you take up the practice of Buddhism, but then you become more confident, you become more positive, and you just get on with life and you forget all about Buddhism. That doesn't lead to Shraddha. Shraddha arises in disillusionment. And that disillusionment is when you see that there's no lasting satisfaction to be found in the mundane. And instead of looking for it in the mundane, you turn towards the transcendental, you turn towards enlightenment. And maybe for most of us, where we experience where we experience dukkha is in a sense of limitation. And we can experience this when we're practicing the Dharma as well. We just experience our own limitation. We've practiced so far and there's so much further to go. We realize there's just so much more. There's so much further to go. And we may do everything we can to cover over that feeling, to disguise that feeling, but instead we should cherish that feeling. I think Subhuti talks about it as the best part of us, because it will keep us searching, it will stop us from settling down, it will keep us looking more and more deeply into the Dharma. So that existential dukkha is necessary to keep us going forward. It goes together with faith. I think faith goes together with dukkha. The two go together. Unless there's a feeling of dissatisfaction, unless there's a feeling there's further to go, then it's not Shraddha. So it's, in a way, it's very good to be dissatisfied with your present experience. You can be perfectly happy on one level, but dissatisfied with your present experience. You realise there's further to go. So cherish that dukkha. So faith is deeper than pleasure. It's deeper from the pleasure that we get from practicing the Dharma. It's deeper than enthusiasm. It's deeper than inspiration and joy. You can't rely on inspiration and enthusiasm being there all the time. They come and go. Good meditations come and go. You need something that will keep you going through all the ups and downs, all the struggles, even through death. So what is needed is commitment. And commitment is the distinguishing mark of Shraddha. And practicing the Dharma can be very demanding at times. I think the Tibetans have a saying that goes, if it's not hard, it's not the Dharma. It doesn't mean it's going to be hard all the time, but they're very suspicious if spiritual life is too easy. And it's very important not to dilute the Dharma, to dumb it down, but to actually practice it in its fullness. And I heard another story, and this happened some years ago in India. And it must have been many years ago, because it concerns Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who's one of Sangharakshita's teachers, and he's dead now, but then he was still alive. And Suvajra went to see Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in India. And Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was in a gompa, he was in a temple, and he was giving a teaching. He was giving an initiation, I think. And when Suvajra went into the temple, it was full of people. There were hundreds of people there taking this initiation from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. But Dilgo Khyentse was an old man, and he was quite a sick man. And I think he died soon after that. But during the initiation, Dilgo Khyentse's attendant came up to him, and he gave him some medicine. He gave Dilgo Khyentse his medicine. And when Dilgo Khyentse tasted the medicine, he made a sour face. Ooh. And Suvajra told Bhante about this. And Bhante said, well, the Tibetans would see everything as symbolic. So they'd say that even for a very, very high lama, the Dharma can still be a sour medicine. So I think it's very important to realize that, and realize that the Dharma is going to be hard at periods, but not to back off. You need to keep going. You need to keep practicing. So joy and inspiration sometimes are compared to a bubbling brook, a bubbling mountain stream flowing down the mountainside, maybe sparkling in the sunlight. And it's very beautiful to look at. It's very fascinating to watch. That's more like joy and inspiration. Whereas Shraddha might be compared to a very, very large, great river, say like the River Rhine. Very powerful body of water, slowly, steadily, deliberately moving down towards the sea. Not very dramatic or exciting to watch, but great weight, this great body of water moving steadily down towards the sea. That's more like Shraddha. That's more like the quality of Shraddha. It's that energy that just keeps going through everything. So faith, or Shraddha, has this subterranean quality, deeper than the ever-changing surface of our minds. It's a deep orientation of our whole being, and it shows itself in the values and principles that we live by, rather than transient feelings. Faith deepens into conviction, and this conviction is the emotional equivalent of wisdom. And another mark of faith is it leads to action. You want to move towards the three jewels, the qualities that you have faith in. Nagarjuna talks about it as leaping forward towards its object. So going for refuge to the three jewels is an expression of faith. And I want to make one more point while we're talking about faith, and that is I think we could have far greater confidence. I think sometimes we lack confidence as a movement because we're quite a new movement, and we've been practicing for a relatively short period of time. But I think we can have great confidence in our movement. We can have great confidence in our teachers, in Bhante and the order members that he's passed his lineage down to, and in the practices and teachings that we follow. And if we had more confidence, I think we'd probably make faster progress because we'd be able to commit ourselves more wholeheartedly to that. And again, I have another little story which concerns Suvajra. And Suvajra, many years ago, used to be Bhante's private secretary. And this was right in the early days of the movement. And at that time, Bhante used to read all the minutes from all the centres twice. And because he was concerned, he was concerned about how the movement was developing. And Suvajra said to him, Bhante, you really don't need to do that. You really don't need to read those minutes. Someone else could do that for you. He said, besides Bhante, there's going to be no one around like you for 30 or 40 years. And Bhante just said, 300 or 400 years more like. So no false modesty there. And I just think we're too close to Bhante to really be able to estimate his importance, not just his importance to us, but his importance in the whole Buddhist tradition. Okay. So faith can be very powerful, but it can lead to dogmatism. It can even lead to a sort of fanaticism, I suppose. You know, so it needs balancing, and it needs balancing with wisdom or prajna. And you're probably familiar with the three levels of prajna. There's listening, reflecting, and meditating. And I'm just going to touch on those very briefly. So the first level is wisdom through listening. And this means studying, getting clear about what the Dharma is saying, and understanding the spirit and letter of the teachings, getting a clear understanding of what the path is. And in The Thousand Petal Lotus, Bhante's memoirs, I think it's called The Rainbow Road now, he spent a number of years wandering in India and meeting various Hindu teachers. One of the teachers that he met was Ram Dass. And Ram Dass was asked, why do so many people start on the spiritual path, but so few make any real progress? And Ram Dass replied, because they have no clear idea of the goal they wish to reach and no clear idea of how to get there. So I've always taken that to heart, that it's very, very important to have a clear idea of the goal that you're heading for, but also a clear idea of the path. Buddhism is vast, and it's not enough just to have a very general idea of the goal and the path. You need a specific teaching from a specific teacher together with a particular group of disciples. And you need to practice that in depth. You need to actually narrow down in order to go deeper. That's not some sort of rule or something. That's the nature of spiritual life. You need to be narrow if you want to go deep. You need to focus on a particular teacher with a particular body of teachings and particular people, a particular sangha that you practice with. And this is what's meant by effective going for refuge, really, or this is one of the aspects of effective going for refuge, that you decided that you want to practice, not just that your practice is generally effective, but that you've decided that you're going to practice with Bhante. You're going to practice particular presentation of the Dharma and in the company of his disciples. Every morning when I go to the shrine room to meditate, I go past Dada Rinpoche stupa in the stupa courtyard here. And as you know, his motto is, what can we say? It's inscribed around the stupa. And that's cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. And you can only cherish the doctrine if you know what it is. You can only go for refuge to the Dharma if you know what the Dharma is. And it's very important to study and get clear about the teachings and to reflect on them. And you need a good knowledge of the teachings of your teacher, the path that you're trying to follow, and of some key texts in the Buddhist tradition. And if you do have that, you'll have much more to offer when you become an order member, when you get ordained. Otherwise, you'll just be thrown back on your own personal experience, which isn't going to be enough if you want to teach. Okay, so the next level is reflecting. It's not enough to study. you need to reflect on the Dharma that you've studied, and you need to apply the Dharma to your own life. You need to make it your own. You need to get it into your bones. And you need to become emotionally convinced of its truth, not just intellectually convinced, but emotionally convinced. So how do you reflect on the Dharma? Well, here's a hint, anyway, of how to reflect on the Dharma. I was struck by a passage which I read in Pieces of Fire. I think it comes from the survey. And this is what Bhante says. He says, many years ago, I constantly asked myself, how does this teaching relate to one's actual experience, spiritual life, and spiritual development? Why did the Buddha say this? Why was the Buddha concerned with this? Where does it connect up with the spiritual life? And he goes on to say that many scholars and even many Buddhists don't do this. So you reflect on the Dharma by reflecting on what it actually means to practice those teachings and why they're important to the spiritual life. And that should be our approach when we come across a teaching. How does that actually connect up with the living of the spiritual life? And then the last stage of wisdom is meditating, where with a calmed, still mind, we bring to mind aspects of the Dharma, and eventually gain insight into them, actually see directly what those teachings are pointing to, the realities that those conceptual teachings are pointing to. So this brings me to meditation. So at the time of the private ordination, most ordinands take up a visualization and mantra recitation practice of a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. And you could say that the Buddha or Bodhisattva practice that you take up at ordination is that particular aspect of enlightenment which you have an affinity with. So this is enlightenment as another person. And people are the form to which we respond to most strongly. There's no abstract enlightenment outside enlightened beings. Enlightenment needs to be embodied. So the figure that we take up to meditate on at ordination is we as we are at the end of the high evolution, we as we are when we gain enlightenment. It's what we can become. In a sense, it's what we already are in our deepest nature. If only we could get out of the way. Please take that poetically. So this gives us a direct approach to enlightenment. This gives us a direct approach to enlightenment in our experience. And when we do a silent practice, we're meditating on enlightenment every day. And of course, you're building up a relationship with a person, even though it's an enlightened person. And that implies continuity. And it implies continuity of practice. And it's best just to do that sadhana every day after ordination. And I mostly meditate on Vajrasattva. And on good days, it feels like a real meeting. He feels like a real presence. And it feels like transcendental Kalyana Mitrita, which I feel I'm recipient to every day. If only I could open up to it. And of course, the figure appears to come and go. Sometimes it's quite vivid. Sometimes there's a definite connection, even a communication. And at other times, the figure appears distant and remote. And this is normal. And you just keep going. And maybe it's good just to think that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva that you meditate upon is above your head all the time. It's only because your mind is clouded and can't see it. But it's good to think that Vajrasattva or whatever figure you take up is there all the time. So all Buddhist meditation practices, if you go deeply enough into them, are samatha and vipassana. They're both calm and insight. All Buddhist meditation practices have the potential to lead to enlightenment, even the mindfulness of breathing. It's sometimes said that it was the mindfulness of breathing that the Buddha was doing when he gained enlightenment. But you just have to go more deeply into them. And as we practice more deeply, we see that all the meditation practices we do are approaching the same goal from different angles. And I really get a sense of this on solitary retreat when I do the whole of the system of meditation in one day or every day, that each of the practices perfumes and pervades all the other practices. In a sense, there's only one practice. And maybe particularly effective for the development of insight is the six element practice, which we meditate on approaching ordination and after ordination. There's also the Brahma Viharas of Metta, Karuna, Mudita and Upekkha. And I've been surprised on Brahma Viharas retreats how strong the insight quality is when you practice these practices intensively. In a sense, you're trying to develop what an enlightened person would feel spontaneously, how an enlightened person would view other people spontaneously. So you're moving towards the emotionality of a Buddha when you do the Brahma Viharas. So I just want to say something about experiences in meditation. And meditation experiences can be an encouraging sign, but I'm not sure that they're that important. I think they can be more temperamental. And they can also get you into trouble if you get attached and start identifying with them. They can make you very unreceptive to the basic work that we need to do, to the basic spade work. You can get stuck on insisting on the specialness of the experience and become only interested in getting back to it. And really, the process is the same with any spiritual experience. First of all, there's a vision, maybe there's a breakthrough, and then it's followed by transformation. And you just transform the whole of your being in the light of that experience. So any spiritual experiences we have need to actually filter through into our behaviour and in helping other people. A friend of mine, Kalyanamati, went to see Sangharakshita with some questions about insight before he was ordained. And I found it very interesting what he told me about his interview with Sangharakshita, which went something like this. And it reads a bit like a Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. And so I just tell you part of their conversation. So first of all, Kalyanamati. I've been doing the six element practice, and while meditating, have sometimes wondered whether a particular experience was insight or not. How can one tell? Bhante, quoting the Diamond Sutra. Should the question occur to a bodhisattva, am I an irreversible bodhisattva? Then he is not an irreversible bodhisattva. Kalyanamati. So, if I'm asking myself these questions, then it is not insight. And if it were insight, I would not be asking myself these questions. Bhante, yes, that is true. Kalyanamati, you seem to be suggesting an approach where you don't concern yourself too much with insight, looking for it or identifying it in experience, but you get on with your practice in an all-round way with insight taking care of itself. Bhante, yes. Otherwise, it is a little like a child continually measuring himself and worrying if he has grown. Instead, all the child needs to do is just drink and eat, and growth will take care of itself. He just needs to keep drinking his milk. Okay, I don't think I need to comment on that. I think that speaks for itself. Okay, so fourthly, virya. And virya means energy in pursuit of the good. Or more accurately, a powerful inclination of our whole being towards the skillful. And virya is what makes transformation possible. Without virya, without energy, without emotional engagement, that we're not going to change. Virya finds expression through the four right efforts. The effort to eradicate arisen unskillful mental states, to prevent unarisen unskillful mental states, to develop unarisen skillful mental states, and to maintain arisen skillful mental states. And at the time of ordination, we recite the 10 precepts, also known as the 10 ordination vows, after our preceptors. And we're effectively, when we take the 10 precepts, they're quite weighty. We're effectively committing ourselves to eradicating and preventing all negative mental states and developing and maintaining all positive mental states. Eradicating greed, hatred, and delusion, and developing love, generosity, and understanding. So in the broadest sense, the 10 precepts are a path to enlightenment. They contain the three great trainings of ethics, meditation, and wisdom, because the last three of the 10 precepts are to do with working on the mind, working directly on the mind. Sometimes at Padmaloka, we study a chapter on ethics from a Sangha's Bodhisattva Bhumi, which is the whole of the Bodhisattva path expressed in terms of ethics. The Bodhisattva's ethics, the ethics of benefiting others. But we already have all this in the 10 precepts. The 10 positive precepts, the 10 Kusala Dharmas. A Sangha just brings them all out more fully. And it's very easy to turn the precepts into something that's mostly to do with our own personal practice. But really, they're mostly to do with our relationship with others. And one of the conditions for the attainment of enlightenment is to do something for others. And it's probably easiest for us to do this through our work for the movement and for the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. The Mahayana speaks of the path in terms of the accumulation of the two stocks, the stocks of punya or merit and the stock of jnana or wisdom. And merit is development of all positive qualities for the benefit of others through skillful actions. It's a broad, stable, positive base which we need to assimilate the wisdom when it arises. And both punya and jnana involve a reorganization of our whole being in relation to enlightenment, living less from a narrow self-concern and more from a sense of connectedness with all life. And probably in our lives, there's a creative tension between these two. Jnana being developing a rich, vibrant inner life, and punya, an intensive engagement with others. And we need to develop both of these together. Okay, coming towards the end now. The last of the five faculties, spiritual faculties, is mindfulness or sati. And there's a lot that could be said about sati, but I've said quite a lot already, and I'm just going to say very, very little about sati, and perhaps you can fill out the other aspects of sati in your discussion groups this afternoon. All I want to say is that the primary meaning of sati is to recollect or to remember. And perhaps our biggest hindrance, or biggest hindrance for many of us, is that we forget. About the importance of putting ourselves in supportive conditions. We forget about the importance of going on retreat. We forget how much we enjoy that, and we lose touch with our original inspiration. We forget about practicing the Dharma for the sake of enlightenment, and we settle for a lesser goal. So it's very, very important, both before and after ordination, to put ourselves into those conditions that actually support our practice and support our accepting this ordination for the attainment of enlightenment. When I was about 22, I came across Buddhism in India with a teacher called Goenka. And after that, I went to art college, and I was very lucky. I was interviewed for art college by a Buddhist, and he became a very close friend, a painter called Peter Schmidt. And he actually took me to a talk by Banti in London, and we were very good friends. And he's a very important person to me. He's dead now, but I still feel very grateful to him. In a way, he was a real teacher, in a way a secular teacher in a sense, but also moving into perhaps even a spiritual teacher. And I was doing painting, and I had this bad habit, which was to start paintings but not to finish them. And one day Peter just sat down beside me, and he said, "I've got a Buddhist friend, and this Buddhist friend says that if you want to practice the Dharma, if you want to gain enlightenment, it's going to take everything that you've got. It's going to take everything that you've got." And then he said, "Paintings like that too." He said, "You need to finish your paintings." So I finished my paintings after that. But I've always remembered that. And, you need to keep working. You need to keep going. You need to finish what you've taken on, what you take up at ordination. You need to finish, however long it takes, over how many lifetimes it takes, you need to finish accepting this ordination for the sake of enlightenment. So I'll stop there.